So here we all are at the towards the end of the third full day. And each one of you is having their own unique journey and process. And there is something like a common trajectory of a retreat like this. Quite common on the third day or around that time is that the hindrances that Yuha was talking about, they're still here, but they've weakened a little bit. Maybe they're not quite as intense as they were yesterday. Maybe there's not quite as much sleepiness or restlessness around as there was yesterday. Our minds are slowly becoming used to the rhythm and are quieting down. And what happens then is things come up. We start feeling things. And many of you have talked about this. So I want to spend some time with this innate ability to feel, this innate sensitivity of the heart. There is this Pali word citta, which Ajahn Sucitto, he's a British-born Theravada Buddhist monk, translates as heart or awareness. And he describes it as this. Citta is the place where the data lands, where contact happens, where feeling gets generated. It is the source of our responses, moment-to-moment inclinations, and engaged intentions. So, it's a bit abstract and theoretical, but basically the heart, the place where we feel, where we are in relationship with experience and the world around us, and from which we respond. But I want to widen our perspective and also bring in many different hearts that have evolved as part of the evolutionary process. Where do you think the biggest heart can be found? The biggest heart can actually be found in one of the smallest beings on this planet. Relatively speaking, in relation to its body weight, the biggest heart is pumping in the chest of a hummingbird. In Finnish, I think you call them kolibris. The heart of a hummingbird is only as big as the nail of an infant. And yet it's incredibly strong. Hummingbirds are the only birds that can fly backwards, which requires a tremendous amount of physical strength. It beats 10 to 20 times per second. Can you imagine? Even if we could hear a hummingbird's heart, we couldn't hear the individual heartbeat. They fly to hundreds of flowers each day to drink nectar. And they can fly more than 800 kilometers without pausing. Quite an impressive little heart that is. The biggest heart in terms of actual size and weight is the heart of the blue whale. The heart of a blue whale is as big as a room, so a little child could actually walk through this heart. And there are the heart valves, which are the parts that open and close, moving blood from one side to the heart to the other. It's that part of the heart that creates that sound. And they are as big as doors to a saloon, opening and closing. This heart beats once every 10 seconds. So imagine, ba-bum. Ba-bum. And each time it pumps 220 liters of blood through the whale's body. It can beat so loudly that it can be heard from 3 kilometers away with sonar equipment. Also pretty amazing. And then there is the human heart. And in here, tonight, there are almost 60 human hearts beating. They are about as big as 2 hands clasped together. And the human heart beats about 100,000 times a day. Over the course of a day, a human heart pumps over 7,000 liters of blood through the human body. And it's really somewhat of a mystery what the heart is. We speak of heartache. And I assume each and every one of us knows what that is. The heart actually aches. We can feel it. What is that? And then it's also somewhat of a mystery. There's reports from heart transplants where, you know, human beings donate their heart to somebody else so they can live. And then the recipient all of a sudden has different preferences of food. Memories related to the donor's life. Personality changes. Isn't that something? Memories that come up. And really, this time in our shared, in our collective history of humankind, I sometimes think of it as really a time of collective heartbreak. These are difficult times. Every living system that we know is in the process of decline. And these almost 60 hearts in here beating, they're affected by this. We feel this. So this is also part of our practice. It goes way beyond this individual process. So here on retreat, we're getting to know this heart much more intimately. And sometimes retreat practice is described as this journey of tenderizing our hearts. Maybe you've heard this term, breaking the heart open. We allow these hearts to be pierced. We let the pain and the sadness and the grief in. And when we do that, the heart breaks. But there's a possibility of it breaking open. Our minds are quieting down because here are no distractions or very few. This continuous bombardment of our senses has stopped. We're no longer numbed down. And we actually slow down so that life can catch up with us. And so we start feeling, and that can be quite unsettling. But it's also a sign that we're reconnecting with this innate, beautiful sensitivity that is attuned to the inside and the outside, that can feel and care deeply. In some way, we're reclaiming being a sentient being. We share that with so many beings out there. We have senses, and that makes us tender and vulnerable. But that's also why we can love and be in relationship with each other. So being sentient means that we will be touched by life. And no matter how hard we try to protect the heart and try and build thick walls around it, we will be touched. There will be this tenderness. Here's Brian Doyle in an essay on the heart. You can brick up your heart as stout and tight and hard and cold and impregnable as you possibly can. And down it comes in an instant, felt by a woman's second glance, a child's apple breath, the shatter of glass on the road, the words, "I have something to tell you." A cat with a broken spine dragging itself into the forest to die. The brush of your mother's papery ancient hand in the thicket of your hair. We are sensitive forms. These human bodies and their hearts and minds. There's a permeability here. Each heart is intrinsically connected with everything surrounding it. And this is true for all life forms. Brian Doyle again. Unicellular bacteria have no heart at all, but even they have fluid eternally in motion, washing from one side of the cell to the other, swirling and whirling. No living being is without interior liquid motion. We all churn inside. Sometimes it can feel like this whole body is made up of jello. You know, there's a loud sound, it's like, ooh, it goes through our entire system, right? Or sometimes there can be a really kind, small but kind, lovely little gesture from someone else. It's like, oh, ooh. Right? We are all liquid inside, we churn inside, we feel things. Things ripple, move through us. And that's a good thing. Even falling apart is a good thing. Says Joanna Macy, this environmentalist and Buddhist scholar that has touched the lives of so many and has really dedicated her entire life to the welfare of all beings and the health of the earth. Joanna just passed away 12 days ago, really after a life of dedication. Here's what she says. It is good to realize that falling apart is not such a bad thing. Indeed, it is an essential transformation as the cracking of outgrown shells. Anxieties and doubts can be healthy and creative, not only for the person, but for the society, because they permit new and original approaches to reality. So something else is being birthed. really this innate sensitivity that is coming alive here, our heartfulness, this capacity to be intimate with life. Can we bow to this? Can we honor this as a movement of life? Because in some way it's also seeing more clearly. It's waking up to a bigger truth. That we're part of a relational network. That each thing leans on the other. We depend on each other in a very fundamental way. So in a way, and that is one of the aspects that I want to explore tonight, is through this sensitivity, through this growing intimacy with life, we're really waking up from the illusion of separation, and we're waking up to the truth of interconnectedness. And there's tremendous freedom there. Because once we start seeing and feeling and understanding this individual as intrinsically connected to everything else, then we can let go of the tiresome and painful self-referencing. We can be held by something larger. We can honor and acknowledge and heal within our individual and unique human story. And we know and feel that there's also a larger truth and a larger story that's just as true. So we are waking up. There's a possibility of waking up to this reality, to this truth of interconnectedness or interbeing, as Thich Nhat Hanh used to call it, that we're all affecting each other deeply with scaring and uplifting effects. The way it is sometimes phrased in the teachings of the Buddha is, everything is dependently arising. Every phenomena that arises, arises in relationship, in dependence with other causes and conditions. Nothing stands alone. Our experience is not separate from the world. Nothing exists independent from another thing. Right now, my experience is informed by all of you here. And your experience is influenced by my words. My well-being depends on your well-being. We touch each other, we depend on each other. And we can inquire on retreat, how is experience shaped? How does it come together? The inner processes and the outer processes that we are embedded in. Some of you have spoken about this, just to notice how, you know, what we eat affects our well-being. The energy available in the body affects our well-being, affects the experience that we're having. The weather, how many mosquitoes are around. A common example that is really also helpful for me to sense into that is a tree. And sometimes you can actually really see in the shape of a tree the different directions. You can see the side of the tree that has received the most sun, the mossy side, where there's least sun, most moisture. Sometimes a tree really leans because from that side, most of the wind is coming. So we call a tree a tree. We give it a noun. We make it a thing. We define it as a thing, as if it was a standalone, separate thing. But really, it's so much more than that. A tree is a product of all the relationships. A tree is really a process. The sun, the soil, the beings that live on the tree, that visit the tree, the weather, all of that is making up the tree. A tree is made up of that. Or how Thich Nhat Hanh would say, a flower is made up of the entire cosmos because it couldn't exist independently of everything around it. Susie Harrington says, the word tree is so limited. This dynamic, changing process of treeing. A tree really being part of the whole. A tree is treeing. I love that. It's like, oh, it's a verb. It's continuously in the process of changing. And we are not so different from a tree. Who is the real you? The grumpy, frustrated one from an hour ago? Or the peaceful one in an hour from now? It's just a continuous process, things moving through this based on causes and conditions, because we're continuously in relationship with everything around us. We're all in this flow. It's just that these minds create the world based on this illusion of separation and stability, permanence. James was had said that I did solitary retreat up in Lapland just before coming here, and that was a real meaningful teaching for me personally on interconnectedness. I was up in Kukkasjärvi, it's close to Kittila, and I spent 8 days out there in the wilds. And one thing that I really take as a gift from this time is that this experience really taught me in a very embodied, physical, body-based way what interconnectedness really means. And this is one of the things that you can track in this practice. There's different levels of understanding. We can read something or understand something intellectually. We can understand an idea. But then sometimes, and many of you have spoken about this, it's like there's like this click moment. It's like, it's the same understanding, but it just, it moves a level deeper, where it somehow becomes more embodied and really moves into our cell. It's like a cellular understanding. And for me, what I learned during these days is really just how much we need each other. On the first day, I went on quite a strenuous hike up a fell, because I wanted to spend that week on top of a fell. But I didn't know where the next water source was. And so in my backpack, there was all the equipment, but also all the food for 8 days, and also 3 liters of water, just making sure. And so I worked myself up this fell, and it was physically very challenging for me, because the sun was relentless. I know in Finland, that was one of the hottest periods in the history. The weather is changing, and the sun was brutal. It was not only brutal on me, it was brutal on all the beings out there. And so when I was finally up the fell, just completely exhausted and sweaty and sticky and itchy from all the bites, almost all of my water had gone, but I was too exhausted to continue going. So I put up my tent and I slept, and the next morning I started looking for water. And this moment when it took me quite some time to find the water source, I hiked for about 1.5 hours, again, back down the fell, when I found this little creek and this body could drink from this source of pure ice cold water. And I could feel the water revitalize this human body that was so dehydrated, bringing it back to life. That changed something in me. But we have created worlds in modern society that are around comfort and availability of products. It's so hard to feel that relationship in everyday life. We open the tap and here comes perfectly drinkable water. And very often we don't think twice about that. In many ways, I really feel, and I could so, it was painful for me coming back into the human realm in some way, because I could just see how we've created this system that is so cut off from all these relationships. And in many ways, it's not surprising that there is a crisis of belonging, because there's a crisis of relationship. We've built technologies and organizations and procedures that take away the direct relationship, the origin from where things come from, our food, our water. So what do we do with this? What do we do with this here on retreat and in our lives? I feel that this way of seeing, this way of seeing that we're all part of this seamless web of interconnectedness, this way of understanding life and experience as a flow of relationship, that can actually be practiced. We can intentionally turn towards that as a way of seeing. And I want to share with you one example of how I practiced with this on retreat. Was at the end of last year, and I was sitting a 2-month retreat in Nepal. And in many ways, that retreat was very challenging for me. There was a lot of resistance to practice. I didn't really relate to the practices. There was very little, basically no community connection. And I felt quite alienated. I was living in this little kuti, it's like a little hut, and there were stories about pythons and all sorts of other wild animals surrounding the kuti. So at times I was quite scared at night. And so this brought up more alienation and aversion. And in my kuti, my home, that kuti was also the home of a large ant colony. And so at times I would come in and they'd be covering the entire floor like a blanket. So no way of, sitting in the kuti or doing yoga or even relaxing in the kuti. And Yuha was talking about the catastrophizing habit of the mind. There was certainly a lot of catastrophizing happening in this mind, because I had been listening to Dharma talks about these yogis practicing in Thailand, waking up in the middle of the night, being covered by red biting ants. And so there's a lot of, just a lot of drama going on in my own head. And really, I think because there was so much alienation and aversion going on to the practice and the retreat in general, these ants became the platform for my aversion. They became my single biggest problem there. It's really interesting to see how the mind created the ant enemy, really. And, you know, I'm a good yogi, so I was committed to the first precept, no killing. I really tried to not squish them. But it wasn't out of sort of care, or I didn't have a heart connection to them. So I would take a shower and I'd be really impatient with them, sort of sweeping them away with frustration and annoyance impatiently. And it was hard. I was annoyed. I was irritated. I wanted them gone. It was clear. And my mind was spinning. You know, how many days am I going to allow that to go on until I go to the Sayadaw and tell him that I really need to move into another kuti, because there's no way I can practice in this way? So you may say, this is kind of a trivial example, but to me, really, I could see the drama of separation and othering unfolding in my human mind. Really othering this, where we create an other, where we say, you are not okay, you are less than, you don't belong here. And we do this in many ways. We can say this to parts of ourselves that we don't like. Like this particular character trait, you don't belong here, you're not okay. I want you gone. We push them away. We do this with other human beings. We do this with whole groups of people, creating a lot of harm on this planet. We do this with the more than human world, creating an other. And so to me, that was a really profound practice with these ants, because I could see the separation so clearly in my mind. You know, there was me, and then there were the ants. We were in opposition with each other. There was either going to be the ants in this kuti or me. And I objectified these ants. I could really see in my mind how I wasn't even really relating to them as living beings. They were a problem. They were a problem that needed to be solved. All of that changed one day. I took a shower and again I swiped them away in my irritated, annoyed state of mind, and after taking a shower, I saw two of them drowned on the floor. And that kind of stopped me in my tracks. And it wasn't so much that, you know, I sort of was harsh on myself, blamed myself, because we human beings, we have big bodies and it happens. But in that moment, I could see, wow, those two beings have lost their life because of my lack of attentiveness. They were alive a moment ago. And ants, always, they're always busy doing something. They were on their way of doing something. And then they died. And it was quite a poignant moment for me. Because I stopped and I asked sincerely, is this how I want to live this life? With this lack of attentiveness? I had been so caught up in my own drama, in the unease and the frustration and the alienation, that my heart was just dulled. And in that, and that's, there's no need for blame. That's a normal human reaction. But in that moment, I could feel the pain of a dulled heart, of a heart that doesn't care. I could feel the numbness and how uncomfortable that is. And you know, you may say, and I agree, there are worse things in this life than, much worse things in this life than two dead ends. And these moments of lack of attentiveness, they can accumulate. Here is Malidoma Somé. He's a writer from Burkina Faso. It's quite a striking statement that he makes. He says, "The modern world steams through life like a locomotive, controlled by an intimidating sense of power, of carelessness, of waste and destruction. Such a life eats at the psyche. As it moves its victims faster and faster along, they are progressively emptied of their spiritual and psychic fuel. They are progressively emptied of their spiritual and psychic fuel." So I started practicing with these ants. I really started integrating caring for these ants intentionally into my practice. I moved much more slowly through my kuti, which also really supported my mindfulness practice, because each step, each movement, I had to be attentive. And I started seeing life through the eyes of ants. You know, how they meet each other and communicate with each other, how they get stressed when I walk into the kuti quickly, how they also move faster, how when there's little drops of water on my table, they come and gather around in little groups and drink from this. And to me, it's still, it's there's something really touching to me about just how much that impacted on my mind and heart. I no longer thought of them as intruders. They were community members. We were sharing this kuti together. And I could actually see my own human arrogance and self-centeredness. It's like, it's my kuti, really? They were here before. And in fact, this entire land was there for the animals to live on before human beings came and built kutis and a meditation center. Right? But it's me, mine. Everything we see, we relate to this human being. Everything we take personally, everything we categorize when we're caught in the story of the self, in the me, we categorize it. Are you contributing to my comfort or are you contributing to my comfort? A discomfort. So living together with them, I started feeling a kind of kinship with them. They too were sentient beings. You know, when they carried their little larvae across the floor, they were doing this really quickly because they care about their young, just like we do. And to me, what's most striking about this, it really wasn't so much the ants that benefited from that practice. It was me, it was my own heart and mind that started relaxing by seeing them as belonging to the kuti. I started feeling belonging. Rob Borbea calls it, "The metta full heart is a happy one. Through metta, the perception of the world changes." I started feeling at home because of the mind states of care and goodwill. Those mind states made it a home for my own heart and mind and for the ants. Mother Teresa, the trouble with you is that you draw your family circle too small. So part of this practice really is seeing how we how the mind creates the story of me and this contracted self that then needs to be defended and protected from the intruders, shifting from that separation to living consciously into relationship. Jack Kornfield. The shift from the small sense of self, what's called the body of fear, that illusion of separation, is to recognize and understand our interbeing with the world. Really seeing that our own happiness and well-being is directly related to the happiness and well-being of everyone else. And when we start doing that, the boundaries between me and other starts melting away, becomes less fixed, becomes more permeable. Ajahn Sucitto, this is a widening out of yourself into something bigger. Can you sense the freedom in this? The human story is just one story. There's something bigger. There's a bigger story here. There's a bigger container that holds this human life. And when we can really into that, live into that, that can be the ground of deep belonging and freedom and fulfillment and peace and loving relationship. So what are your ant teachers here on retreat? What's your object of aversion? What is the one thing that you say that the mind says, oh, I wish if that one thing just went away, then everything would be fine. What if that part actually wants to be seen, wants to be tended to, wants to be cared for, wants to be brought in rather than pushed away? A few years ago, I had a retreat, and it was a long retreat at IMS in Massachusetts, and it's a big hall. It's about space for about 100 yogis, and I come into the hall early so I can reserve the spot in the hall that's just right for me. You know, close enough to the teachers so I can really see them and take them in, but not too close, not in the first row, so I don't feel like I'm continuously seen by them. So I found the perfect spot. I remember there was one spot right in front of me, and I was like, oh, no one's going to take that. This is just going to be completely perfect. And just before the first sitting, this yogi comes in, a man, really tall, and sits there and just blocks my entire view. And not only that, also what sort of evolved over time was he was a smoker, because sometimes what happens for me as retreat deepens, like my sense of smell just gets so incredibly sensitive that I could literally already smell when he was coming in the hall. So, aversion. He needed to go. I didn't want him there. The smell of smoke was making me feel nauseous. There's a whole, you know, family history, childhood thing going on. with smoke smell and all of that. And I was sitting in aversion with this yogi for many weeks. And you know, over time, the mind gets more quiet, there's more unification, samadhi, and so the aversion became smaller, but it continued to be there. You know, if somebody had asked me, oh, you know, is it your preference that this yogi sits somewhere else? Even on the last day, I would have said, yes, that'd be great. The very last day after closing of retreat, we're all sitting there and we just had finished the ceremony to close the retreat. And so people started talking to each other. He turns around directly towards me. And I could tell right away how moved he was. And, you know, his eyes were teary. There was this bear of a man really, really touched. And he leans in and he says, thank you. You sitting there like a mountain, you supported me throughout all these weeks. Ah. That was really humbling. I was like, thank goodness he cannot hear thinking. But all of a sudden, his humanity came back. I could not see him as a problem, as this irritating smoking smell. He's a human being that probably went through a lot of difficult stuff through these weeks. Can you see? It's so important. This practice is so important on so many levels, and so what we're needing, not only in our own individual lives, but really in this world. And it's really important to recognize that this habit of creating separation, of objectifying, of othering another, is really not personal. We've all been exposed to cultural conditioning that creates that as a habit. You know, this story of the strong, independent individual is a part of the worldview that we've been educated with. There is John A. Powell. He's the director of the Othering and Belonging Institute in the Bay Area. And he's really studied or developed a deep understanding of othering and separation in the context of creating the individual. You can really see how that is also related to these larger forces of capitalism, patriarchy, white superiority, all of that is in the mix. And he uses as an example John Wayne. You know, I hope some of you know John Wayne, you know, these old movies, these Western movies, this classical male and or stereotype of the strong cowboy. And John A. Powell says about John Wayne, as far as I can remember, John Wayne never kissed a baby, never had a romantic relationship. He went in, he shot up the town, and he left. He was on his own. He was by himself. Right? We're fed. This mind is fed with images like that. They live in our heart and mind as well. And as we are cultivating awareness, some of these things pop up and we get to see them. And when we see them, they can no longer operate in the subconscious. That's the power of awareness, of mindfulness. There's a really important relationship here. What we feel separate from is what we fear. And what we fear, we try to control and dominate. What we feel separate from, we fear. And what we fear, we try to dominate, control, exploit. And we can see that in these minds, but we can also see that in the larger world. You know, the wilderness spaces that are shrinking. We are afraid of forests, the wild. So we control these precious places. So to open up to interdependence, to this way of seeing the interconnectedness of things, is also to come across, to rub against all that is in the way. And fear is often in the way. Tanisara, Dharma teacher, can we see the seed of violence in our own hearts? How quickly this othering happens. We create walls, divisions, we react, not from what we're seeing, but really from our own fears. And when I was up there on the fell, I had plenty of opportunity to look at that. Oh, I have this. It's a funny thing for me about Finland. Actually, something I appreciate about Finnish culture. I don't want to make like a blanket statement about it, but I have this recurrent experience where brown bears live in the wilderness of Finland, but nobody seems to talk about it. It's a really interesting phenomenon to me. And I have this taxi driver, this really kind man, who drives me into the wilderness because there's no public transport. And each time he's like, yeah, yeah, don't worry about bears. But then when I come out, he shows me, you know, these images on his phone of like huge paws with this fascination. I'm like, oh. And for some reason, it's unrelated to my life, but I do have this ingrained fear of bears. So it's really an edge for me to be out there. And it's so interesting how it shapes perception. You know, how I can see my eyes scanning the horizon. It's so, the mind picks up on regularities. You know, that'd be like, oh yeah, trees, rocks, irregular shape, bear, question mark. This is what we do. And I could so sense how when fear is there, I was so aware of my skin. I was so aware of the boundary of my body because fear is very concrete and very personal. It has one objective and purpose, and that is to protect this one body. So it's really powerful. But can we bow to fear and respect it as this incredible force of life, really this ancient program of life to protect itself? And I don't think fear can be remedied or pulled out like a rotten tooth or exercised. But there's a way to really, really gently, step by step, get to know fear, respect fear, bow to fear, and find a way to skillfully relate to fear that's respectful, but that's not running the show. So, closing this, I may be bringing it home to this initial question. So what are we being called for in these times of unraveling, things falling apart, of separation, of polarization, of collective heartbreak? Hear here in retreat, we come to see life as a process, as a flow. And what happens is, instead of relating to this human being as one solid, isolated piece on a chessboard, we shift our attention and we see that every moment is made up of all these processes and relationships. And so rather than fruitlessly trying to control this life or how this retreat is going or this mind, the possibility is to tune into these relationships and become intimate with all beings inside and outside. The shift can really be from separation to connection. Sharon Salzberg puts it beautifully. Being fully connected to our own experience, excluding no aspect of it, guides us right through to our connectedness with all beings. There are no barriers, there is no separation. We are not standing apart from anything or anyone. We are never alone in our suffering. And we are not alone in our joy. Because all of life is a swirl of conditions, a swirl of mutual influences coming together and coming apart. By going to the heart of any one thing, we see all things and we see the very nature of life. And so we're left with this invitation and challenge to, on the one hand, be pierced by life, be touched by life, care for life, but without numbing and without, you know, falling into despair or complete overwhelm. So how to be in this world? Let's learn from some of the elders. Because to me, this perspective of interconnectedness can become such a refuge, can become a source of our power, of our strength, of our resilience. Joanna Macy interviewed John Seed, who is another environmentalist and part of the deep ecology movement in Australia. He's a deep practitioner, and he's also dedicated his entire life to protecting the rainforest there. And I've only just recently learned that this quote that I'm going to share with you actually happened after a retreat he set, and he heard in the background chainsaws. So at some point, he actually left the retreat and went to that part of the rainforest together with his activist friends to try and stop the cutting down. And so Joanna at some point asked John Seed, so how do you deal with the despair? Because we know how many trees are being cut down every minute. So here's what he says. I try to remember that it is not me trying to protect the rainforest. Rather, I am part of the rainforest protecting itself. I am that part of the rainforest. Recently emerged into human thinking. Doesn't that change everything? It's not about fixing this world or saving this world. It's about participating in it. Each one of us in our own way. Each one of us in our own way. Here is Llewellyn Van Lee, Sufi mystic. The world is not a problem to be solved. It is a living being to which we belong. The world is a part of our own self, and we are part of its suffering wholeness. Until we go to the root of our image of separateness, there can be no healing. And the deepest part of our separateness from creation lies in our forgetfulness. Our forgetfulness of its sacred nature, which is also our sacred nature. What if we went through life remembering this? For me, it's an invitation to fall in love with this life in this world. Deeply, each day as we go. And when we start seeing how we all lean on each other, how we all depend on each other, how everything we do affects everything else, then we no longer need to believe in the insignificance and irrelevance of our lives. Because we know that at each and every moment, we have the possibility of sowing new seeds, of creating new conditions, and that will affect the whole. I'm closing with a poem by Rabindranath Tagore, an Indian writer and poet. The same stream of life that runs through my veins night and day runs through the world and dances in rhythmic measures. It is the same life that shoots in joy through the dust of the earth in numberless blades of grass and breaks into tumultuous waves of leaves and flowers. It is the same life that is rocked in the ocean cradle of birth and of death, in ebb and in flow. I feel my limbs are made glorious by the touch of this world of life. And my pride is from the life throb of ages dancing in my blood in this moment. Let's take a moment of silence together. I feel my limbs are made glorious by the touch of this world of life, and my pride is from the life throb of ages dancing in my blood this moment. Thank you very much.